Welcome to 20 Minutes and Two Beers In. This is Bobby hanging out in the studio with you this week. I'm by myself, JD's on little Christmas vacation, and I know a lot of you guys are out there. I appreciate you tuning in and listening to us. Hope you're having a great time with your family and your friends. If you're new to the podcast, well, this is a great one to listen to. If you're a fan of the podcast, well, you're also in for a treat too. We had a lot of great interviews this year. We've pieced together what we think are three of our finest interviews this year. We had Michael Bernard Fitzgerald, Randy Sklar of the Sklar Brothers, and also Emily Wells. Really great guests to have in the studio. We're going to start you off here with our interview with Michael Bernard Fitzgerald. It was a really great time. We talked to him back in February, right when his EP was just about to come out, and he also had a new album upcoming. So he's just about to go on tour, so he talks all about going on tour and what to expect from the new album. Give it a listen.
Like 10 years and two more, and I held the girl closer than was safe. Take what you want from me, I'm not afraid to turn around to see.
Welcome back. We're joined by Michael Bernard Fitzgerald. He's the Calgary native, and he's a musician. You can follow him on Twitter at ilovembf. Also, his website's ilovembf.com. He's got a new album coming out this year. We're very excited to have you on. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
We're very excited, not only that you're our first Canadian that we've had on 20 Minutes and Two Beers In, but we love your sound. It is extremely unique. We both have your first release and anxiously anticipating your next release coming out here this spring. Tell me first, the new album, you've got a title, and when is it going to drop?
The new album is called Yes, and we're going to put out a couple songs from it with a live cut as an EP on March 5th, and then the album itself is going to be coming out, I've been told, on May 21st.
Outstanding. And I know you have a little tour coming up. It starts March 28th. You're actually going to be in Chicago, where we are, March 29th at The Space in Evanston. Are you going to be doing another tour after that to support the album?
Yeah, I mean, if I had my way, they would kind of just roll into the next one, and would just stay out for a little bit. As I haven't played as much as I'd like to in the last while, just because I have been waiting for a release to come out. So now that it's about to come out, and then once it's out, I really hope to be playing a lot of shows.
Now, playing live in a previous interview, you had mentioned playing live's totally why you're into this, that you just mm-hmm. love playing live. What is it about playing live that charges you up?
I think it's just I love that it's just in the moment. You know, it's one of those things you can't predict, you can't plan for everything. It's off the cuff, and I really love that. I love the improvised moments, and I love kind of how the crowd and the band, they kind of mix, and then, you know, that the energy kind of just grows in the space. It is exactly why I'm into this.
And you're not afraid from taking risks when you're out there on stage. I mean, you're a person who's had 250 people on stage with you at one time. I mean, what's that like to have a band of that size playing with you?
Well, it's fine. I mean, the night we did that was in February of last year, and I'd done 120 before that, and I did 60 before that. I'd done it a couple times, but it's a lot of prep work to get it ready, and then I guess in the moment it's a bit of a whirlwind.
Speaking of whirlwind, you spent some time in Australia. And that really helped shape your current sound. What was it about your experience there that really transformed your music?
I don't know if it completely transformed it. I think that was the first trip that I was just on my own, and I was playing an acoustic guitar, and that's kind of where it started.
Were you doing a lot of busking when you were in Australia?
No, I've always had a policy against busking.
Oh, really? Why is that?
Yeah, because I just thought, well, why busk when I can just plan a show instead?
Oh, all right. Got bigger plans than just busking on a street corner. That's cool.
Yeah, you plan a show and then plan a bigger show and then plan a bigger show after that. This is the way I always looked at it.
How would you actually, right now, how would you describe your sound? Because you can tell through your first release and then even going into some tracks in your upcoming EP that your sound continues to evolve, and it, at times you have a really big sound, and other times you're really able to scale it back. So I know artists don't like to classify themselves, but how would you, if you had to... We're putting you on the spot. How would you describe your sound?
It's an easy answer. It's a bit of metal and a bit of gospel.
Oh, I like it. I like it.
Well, you know, you have with the MBF Love LP, you had a great buildup of sounds. I really, I thought it was a great ambitious sound for somebody for their first album. It sounded like you're a veteran. Seriously, when you're having that. That kind of marching band percussion is what I noticed a lot throughout mm-hmm. those tracks. Were you in band growing up?
No, but I just randomly I started meeting people that did that, and I just thought it would be cool to put the two things together.
Now, when you were writing tracks for that, would you start out with something on your acoustic, and then in your head you're hearing that percussion, you're like, yeah, I definitely want to add that, or how did that work?
Yeah, I think with that music as well, we just kind of tried out anything. Just invited a bunch of people down, from horns to singers to marching band percussionists to kind of everything I could think of, and just tried it out.
That's insane. That's great. One thing you've mentioned, you feel like you've grown up a lot in the last 2 years. You had mentioned in another interview. How do you feel you've grown?
Well, I think the songwriting has definitely changed a lot. I mean, I guess that last record was released in June of 2009. And so I wrote it kind of between, you know, mid-2007 to 2009. I meant to put out a release after, like closer to that one, but it just, the way it all worked out is it just... you know, kind of here we are, right? It's and it's about to come out. So I just think in all that time and going from the last label to then being independent again after, you know, we kind of parted ways. We weren't quite getting along, so we just parted ways. So I just have had to learn a lot more about this business that I'm in. And then kind of the way it always works with me, I just end up meeting the people I need to meet, I guess, at the right time. So I met John and Brian just randomly. I met John. I was driving my van through the States just for a month by myself, just to enjoy myself and have a bit of a vacation. And a publisher that I work with in Toronto set me up on a co-write with John. And the first day we worked together, we wrote this song called I Will, which is probably the most beautiful love song I've ever written. And so that was, you know, that was day one, right? So I just decided, well, that, you know, I'll just work with them, right? Like I've never to search out producers or this or that. So I just, all the pieces have been kind of falling into place. And then I guess throughout all that, I just, you know, I guess you grow up.
Excellent. Well, we're excited about, and we're glad you met John and Brian, because we got to get a new album out of you. And the first single is going to be, is Firecracker. We're going to play that one now. For everybody to listen to, and then when we come back, we're going to ask you more about that new album.
Sounds great.
Educated, I'm a lady, confiscated, eyes like she took who am I to walk on? I'm strong, couldn't if I try, couldn't pass go. I bet, take that, I feed a sheep, have me at a low. She's a winner, I'm a sinner, I face my order for her, she's my favorite meal. I gotta tell her, I'm a wealthy seller on me, oh my, I'm a fool for you, babe. Play to pay you later, alligator, cause I know, no.
Today, oh, why you have to walk like that?
And that was Firecracker. That's the new single from Michael Bernard Fitzgerald. We're joined by him again. The new album's called Yes. It's coming out tentatively May 21st with an EP coming out on March the 5th. How is recording different for this album than it was when you did the MBF Love LP?
I think I was a bit more carefree this time around. And like we talked about before you played the track, I also a little bit more grown up. I think that I just found the sessions to be a lot easier. I think the other thing that also plays a big role in that is that leading up to it and during the process of recording, I was still touring as much as possible, and I think that keeps you in a pretty real place when you're going in to do these studio sessions instead of getting caught up in trying to get, you know, strive for perfection or something like that. I think playing out allows you to just be thankful that, you know, you're in there tracking, and then, you know, to just take, you know, whatever you get and just really enjoy it, you know?
As the second release comes out, do you feel pressure to have success? Now you've got, you're signed with a bigger label, but also touring here in the States a little bit more.
Do I feel pressure?
Yeah.
No.
Good.
Easy answer.
I set out at the beginning when I started doing this, and all I wanted was every year to be better than the one before it. So, I mean, that's happened every year. So, I mean, and already it's happening, you know, in 2013. So really, I don't have the stress. I have no complaints either.
Excellent. Well, what can we expect with this tour coming up? Are we going to see you solo? Or are you going to be having a band with you at this time?
Well, I think this run is solo. I'm not quite sure. I think it's solo though, and we're doing a couple different configurations. So we're doing, I play solo sometimes. Then we also sometimes play shows where my friend Andrew plays this beautiful, this big, like, it's almost like this marching drum kit, native drum. It's like this single booming, like bassy drum, and then we have a couple girls that sing backups as well. So it's like four part harmonies with this drum and an acoustic. So we do that a bit, and then the full band is like two drummers and bass and keys and backup singers and horns and all that stuff, you know. So I think once we get into festival season this summer, we'll get to start coming out with you know, the bigger band. But I think some of these tours before. No, solo.
Tell me a little bit for and I don't mean to push it beyond this May 21st release of your new EP, or the EP's the March 5th, the full album's May 21st. But a lot of artists, when they're on tour promoting an album, they're already writing the next one. Is that your process, or how does your process work?
You know, I'm gonna say I'm a lazy writer, which is bad. I think there's everyone's got a different practice, and some people kind of go day in and day out and just write and write and write. And I could stand to write a bit more, but at the same time, I kind of like, you know, I found the producers and found, you know, the team I'm working with just by happenstance. I also love when the songs come up, you know, I guess naturally, you know, like Firecracker. We wrote that one so fast, and there's a song called In Your Room Tonight, which we, you know, I just put my iPhone on the table and just made it up on the spot. We didn't make any changes to it. It was made up in 8 minutes, you know, and same with that song, Love Is an Easy Thing to Miss, which is going to be on the EP as well on March 5th. That song, again, just iPhone was out and it was all stream of consciousness. So if I could have my way, when we decide to get into studio, I want to get back into studio with John and Brian, because I love supporting the same people and working with the same people. That to me is such a rewarding experience. But when we get into the studio, I'd love for the songs to just come out like that again.
Be very nice to have that again. Well, with your writing process, are you coming up with the melody first or the lyrics?
Again, I mean, I'm coming up with whatever kind of flows first, you know? I mean, sometimes you have like a rhythm that starts it off, and sometimes you have a guitar thing that starts it off. Like in that Love Is Anything to Miss song, I was listening to that, a song by Drake actually called Marvin's Room, and I really liked how kind of sparing the music was, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I just started playing the guitar and trying to find something that felt really sparing like that, had a lot of space in it. And I came with a guitar line to that. And then just my friend Josiah came in the studio and heard me play the guitar line. He said, well, why don't you call it Love Is Anything to Miss? And then the song was made up in no time. We just went to Umami in Hollywood for burgers.
Even better, get a break for burgers.
You talk about your one simple goal is to pursue your craft as honestly as possible. What do you mean by that?
Devoid of the smoke and mirrors, I guess. You know, Ryan actually and I were just on the phone. We were talking about how, you know, some people believe that within music there's this competition, and I honestly think that music is, and I don't really play. Actually, I don't play at all. But I think music is like a golf game. You know, you're just out there. You just like, it's personal best, you know. So, I think that I've lost myself. I got talking about golf, and I just I lost. I'm lost.
I'm a golfer. You had me.
Good. The golf metaphor really drove it home. Good. Right. But I totally forget what we're talking about. So maybe.
Just being as honest as possible with
you. Oh, yeah, honesty. See, I was honest with you that I forgot talking about.
There you go.
I could have just kept on talking and try to get back to the point. But, you know, I just want to play, right? Like, I mean, the songs have got a good message, and I meant every word that's on the whole, on that record. It's not like we went through the label process where they liked one song and then they sent me back and they said, let's make more songs like that. We like that side of Michael, you know?
Yeah.
I came in and I said, you know, my name is Michael Bernard Fitzgerald. It's really long, but that's what my name is. And I was, because of the work we'd done independently, I was able to actually just hand in the record. We didn't go back and do anything. I mean, that's what I mean. It's just saying, this is what it is, you know, go out to play the shows. I mean, meet all the people and just spread the good word.
Nice.
Outstanding. Well, Michael, we're going to put you on the hot seat now with our six pack of questions. So we're going to come at you. You're going to have to be honest here. You've been honest the whole time. We're going to keep you to that. My first question is going to start with me. What's your favorite song to play live?
Ooh, my favorite song off the new record to play live is In Your Room Tonight.
Why is that?
Because it's always me solo. It's always at the end of the night. Every time I played it, I probably played it out maybe 40 times now. And it does the same thing every time. The crowd is completely quiet. And it's just it's a great connection every time.
All right. All right. Well, hey, you have said you've played in crappy rock bands back in high school. I want to hear a name of a rock band that you played in high school, because it had to have a crappy name too, right?
Yeah. It. You know what? I'm going to honestly tell you, I'm not going to answer that question, but Yeah, you know, I'm thankful for the experience back then. But yeah, it's I'm really happy that we ended up where we did.
Oh, that is so politically correct. All right.
What is your if you had a bucket list of venues to play, what is the biggest venue you want to play?
Oh my gosh, like in terms of seat size or in terms of like being built up in my mind or what?
In your mind, what's the big one?
You know, I think it'd probably be like a three-way tie between like the Hollywood Bowl. Mm-hmm. That'd be really cool. When I was younger, my mom and I went to New York and we did a tour of Carnegie Hall. Mm-hmm. That'd be really cool. And I think the third place is the O2 in London.
Oh, nice. You could probably fit a ton of people on stage for that one if you wanted to break your 250-person record.
Yeah, actually, we've talked about a couple times now breaking that 250 and doing something bigger. And, I mean, I think we're gonna do it. I just don't know when.
Awesome.
Nice. All right. Well, hey, if you weren't a musician, what would you be? What would that dream job be if you were not a musician?
It'd be any job without a boss.
No boss?
No boss.
No boss. I'm the boss. I think I would, if I wasn't doing music, I think I'd probably I'd be eager to become an entrepreneur in some other way, just because I find it's pretty exciting. And then, but I've also toyed around with ideas of being a farmer numerous times.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, I think part of that life would be really, really rewarding.
Well, I have my last question for you, and this one's going to be the most difficult question I think you're going to face tonight. On the world of Black and White, that's off the EP that's on Spotify,
yeah.
In the beginning, you kind of name-dropped some holograms. If you could have a hologram on stage with you, what hologram would you have on stage with you?
Well, I'm gonna say one thing before I answer that question, if that's all right, if you permit
me. Yeah,
go ahead.
So when we were in the studio, we did the same thing on another song called Last Train to Georgia. And before every vocal take, I would just yell these two cameo appearances in the songs. And so, like, we've actually talked about taking all of those, you know, those first, say, 15 seconds of both songs and taking all those and cutting and pasting them all together so you can hear. It was different. It was a different two. Like, I racked my brain every time to come up. I always wanted to have an actor and some sort of, like, just fantasy. I just try to think of the craziest combination possible. So that's where that whole thing started. And then in the end, the one at the beginning of World of Black and White and the one at the beginning of Last Train to Georgia, they stayed right until mixing and mastering.
Nice.
And we actually went back and we took them out and listened to the songs again. And the songs just weren't right without those bits. but in terms of a hologram, I guess that would imply the person has passed on.
It could be, or you could have somebody living hologram if you want to go that route.
Oh, I don't know. I mean,
it's going to be weird either way. Let's be honest.
Maybe we have the cast of Star Trek Next Generation. How about that? They could just hologram right out of the holodeck.
Nice. I think you just got a bunch of Star Trek fans to be fans of you now, too.
Well, you know what? That's great. That's a good idea, I think.
Well, our last question of the six-pack, and we always have beer on the podcast. What is your beverage of choice?
Well, when we are out on the road or traveling, my drink of choice is Jameson.
Outstanding.
Nice.
Because it is delicious. It doesn't make you feel full like beer. And it is usually served pretty much everywhere.
Definitely.
So I'm into that. But when I'm home, I mean, still I'm into the Jameson because it's also the low-calorie choice, I would say. But because, I mean, if you're drinking a lot of them, you got to kind of be cognizant of that.
There you go. You got to stay fit.
After a few cities, yeah, you know, you start to show the wear is what I guess I'm trying to get at. But actually at home, I was approached a bit over a year ago by a good friend of mine, and he started a brewery here in town, and so they brought on a bunch of people, between some artists and some businessmen, and we all became owners of the company, and we're all dubbed Beer Barons. And the brewery is actually pretty close to the house, and the brewery is doing really great. I mean, the goal is only to support Calgary and to get the beer all over the city. But it's that would be my beer of choice here. It's called Village Brewery.
Village Awesome. Brewery. We'll have to check it out.
Love it. Well, his name is Michael Bernard Fitzgerald. He's a dog man with good plan and two hands, and we really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for your time. I appreciate the interview.
And make sure everybody that's in Chicago, you hit him up at the Space in Evanston. It's March 29th. And he's also all over the Midwest. The tour starts March 28th. It ends up in Canada on April the 18th. The album, again, is called Yes. It drops May 21st. The EP comes out March 3rd.
And 29th is one day after my birthday, so I'm still accepting birthday presents.
Standard.
Just so everyone knows. But yeah, thank you again.
Just what was going on when all my guts were telling me to run a stop around when I should have been there with you.
That was Michael Bernard Fitzgerald back in February. As you know, he had a great album come out. I think it was in June or July. Fantastic album. And now we're on to our next interview. We were lucky to have Randy Sklar, half of the Sklar brothers, in as they were coming in town. This interview was from May of this year, and they were coming into Chicago for a couple shows, so we had them on to promote that. We also talked all about their podcast. We talked about Cheap Seats. We put them on the six pack. It was a lot of fun. Give it a listen.
Identical twins Jason and Randy Sklar are actors, comedians, and podcast gurus. You may know the Sklar brothers from a number of shows, including ESPN's classic Cheap Seats, History Channel's United Stats of America, MTV's Apartment 2F, and of course Nerd Down in 10 on the YouTube. On the YouTube. You like
on
that?
The
on
YouTube.
The YouTube.
You sound like an old man.
I do.
On the YouTube. Make it plural. Why not make it plural? YouTube.
They've also appeared on Entourage, Grey's Anatomy, Curb Your Enthusiasm, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, CSI, Chelsea Lately, whole slew of movies, including The Legend of Awesomest Maximus.
Classic.
And
so fun.
They have three stand-up albums. You have to check out their latest one, Henderson's and Daughters. Plus, Randy and Jason currently host weekly sports comedy podcasts, Sklarborough Country and Sklarborough County. To date, 140 episodes of Country, 53 of County. With us, Randy Sklar.
Hey, that is a fantastic introduction. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Anytime the interview goes, or I'm sorry, the introduction goes over 30 seconds, you got to be proud of yourself.
I am proud. That was like our whole canon right there.
Well, I have to tell you, Randy, this is, what, episode 128 for us?
Yeah.
Your guys' show was definitely an inspiration for us to do this. And we definitely have stolen some ideas and themes from you guys over the years. So thank you.
You're welcome. No, if we can inspire people, I mean, as fans, you know, coming up through it, we had people that we truly loved and you know, just admired. And I would say our stuff that we did, you know, we never liked to, you know, steal stuff. But, I mean, we would pay homage to the people that we loved and all the time. So I really take it as a high compliment.
Well, you're going to be in Chicago at the Up Comedy Club. Got show recording the podcast. Are you going to record Country or County on Thursday?
We're going to do Country, although we just got our lineup of guests all solidified, so I'm so excited. We've got Casey Urlacher is going to be there. We'll obviously talk a little Brian, and he played for the Bears too.
Yeah.
So we'll just talk about that from a man who probably knows a lot of what was going on. We're going to have Steve Gall on, which I really, kind of a Chicago radio legend, as I'm sure you guys know.
Absolutely.
And then we're also going to have Tim Kazurinsky on, which I'm really excited about because I was a fan of his. We've been fans of his for so long. So he's going to be on. We're going to do, you guys mentioned Cheap Seats at the beginning, our show on ESPN Classic. We are going to at the beginning of the show, be breaking down one of the greatest videos ever that we found on YouTube of a guy doing basically freestyle canoeing, an old man freestyle canoeing to the song Lady in Red. It may be the most haunting thing you've ever seen in your entire life, and that includes Michael Douglas in a bald cap, naked in Beyond the Candelabra.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's going to be great.
That's quite a lineup, especially getting the video. I think anytime you can break a YouTube video to people, you also should be pretty impressed with yourself.
Well, people may have seen it, but they will not have seen it the way we are about to break it down, cheap seat style. It is so fun and funny. I can't wait to do it. And then, of course, we've got Dan Van Kirk will be with us. He's going to sit in kind of almost county style as we interview Steve Dahl, because he's just one of the biggest fans, Dan being from Rochelle, Illinois, and kind of, you know, living around Chicago. And then, you know, he might pop in. Seagal might pop in. Doug Buffone might make an appearance. And, of course, Mark Wahlberg at the end will be there. So, gotta love that. Mark Wahlberg, it's going to be fun. It's going to be really, really fun. I'll say this. We've done now 5 live shows. They are the most fun thing in the world because fans are so psyched. They love to see the process and how it happens live. Everybody's in such a good mood. It's just, you know, it's like a victory lap. It's so much fun. And with the guests we have and the things we have planned, it's just going to be a blast.
As a diehard Cardinals fan, do we have to put extra security around Wrigley Field while you're here?
I am a diehard Cardinals fan, although I do love Wrigley Field. I think it's, you know, that and Fenway Park. I know it's, like, traditional to say that, but I've been to probably about 20 ballparks, and those are my 2 favorites. They're amazing.
Well, speaking of podcasts, you've been doing your podcast for quite a while now. What have you learned with the process?
You know, you learn how to get better at what you do as far as, like, interviewing guests and stuff. We've sort of, the interview has morphed and changed into, you know, a new and different thing that, you know, we kind of know the questions that we want to ask and the areas we want to go. And, you know, listening to friends' podcasts, like Pete Holmes is a good friend of ours. And I love how real he gets on his podcast. So Jay and I have made a real concerted effort to make sure that when we're interviewing people, yes, we gag around and have fun, but also it's okay to get real with people and dig in and find out kind of what they're really thinking about things and let whatever happens in the moment happen and trust ourselves that it's going to be fun. And then, you know, breaking down the stories, it's so funny because we start the week and we're like, we have no idea what we're going to talk about this week. And every single week, something happens. Like Hulk Hogan winds up having a radiator explode in his hand and he live tweets the surgery of it. Or, you know, Jose Canseco does something stupid. Or, you know, I mean, this crazy stuff happens every single week. And the beauty is that, like, we feel like we can break down anything. And it's gotten us really good at taking stories and breaking it down. And so we've learned a lot through the whole process and to trust ourselves that we can do it. I feel like it's made us way better broadcasters doing nearly 150 countries and 54 counties. It's amazing.
And with those shows, I know in previous interviews you've said you guys script out about 40 minutes of material for each show. So how much prep time in the week are you guys actually working on getting ready for country and county?
County is less prep time, and so it's a little bit easier for us. We just have to make sure that we book a secondary guest or get another, you know, that final element of the show. You know, we want usually like a character or something. So coordinating that and then figuring out the idea, we like to go through the beats of that with whoever we're doing it with. That takes some time on county. But country, we just sort of say, what are the stories we really... I mean, it just keeps us writing every week. It's a great exercise to get us ready to do to work because, you know, you're writing jokes about stories and things come up. And, I mean, the best is to take stuff that we're doing in the podcast and then convert that into stand-up bits that we can do. You know, that's been more rare, but, you know, it's fun. I mean, I think it's great to know that we have that ability to do that.
Who's been your favorite interviewee over the years?
You know, there are a couple. I mean, John Hamm is just amazing. And our connection with him for St. Louis and, you know, as Cardinals fans, I mean, Hamm is so great. It's so funny because I'm so into Mad Men and I'm watching the show and I watch it and it's like I don't even see my friend there. I just see the character. He's that good. And I guess maybe it helps that it's a period piece and whatnot, but still, I'm just so amazed. But then he comes on the show and we just like start riffing right away. He's such a good riffer. And, you know, the connection goes back. Like, it was so funny when the Cardinals made the run and won the World Series in 2011. It didn't look like we were going to beat the Phillies. And then we come back and beat the Phillies and then, you know, Milwaukee. What was so great about it is throughout the whole series, Jay and John and I were, like, emailing each other as we're watching the game. It was like a three-way email. Like, the rally squirrel happened, and, like, John is, like, sending us pictures of the rally squirrel. And, you know, it's like, if you have that, and we're making jokes the entire time about how much we don't believe in the Cardinals and how bad it's going, and then, of course, they win, and there's egg on our face. And, I mean, the beauty of that is you take that sort of relationship into a podcast, and it comes through. It shines through. There's, like, a relationship before you even get in there. So I love him. I love Patton Oswalt because he is not a sports fan, but he's so eager to know about the world that he kind of looks at it with the eyes that we want fans of ours who don't know sports to look at it. He's kind of like, it's like teaching it to him in many ways. And he's fascinated by the quote-unquote sports villains, which he thinks are more villainous than anything that a comic book could ever come up with. Like, Gilbert Arenas having a shark grotto in his backyard when he's got young children. It's just like, who makes that up? It's crazy. So, I mean, he's a great guest to have on. So much fun. You know, we had a great time with Jack Black when he was on. Just fun. I mean, we know him and have known him for many years, but what came out and what we'd hoped would come out is a friendship based on goofing around and laughing, that really came out. And so, and what's great is you look over the breadth of this whole and the width of this whole podcast that we've done, and I feel like it really shows all the relationships that we've made throughout our time in the industry, which is impressive, and I'm proud of us, you know.
And I have to ask you, you've been doing this for so long, but you have also been doing stand-up and acting. So stand-up, acting, podcasting, which do you like doing best?
I mean, they're all awesome, and I'll tell you, stand-up is great because it is the craft that I feel like we came up on. We came up with stand-up. Acting is fun because it's just, especially when someone else writes it, and you just come in and you feel like a hired gun, and you go in and you do justice to your scene, and you're making something come to life. It's super, super fun. And podcasting is great because I feel like it's the purest form of us. We're not, because there's not an audience, we're not really worried whether people are laughing or not. We kind of are like, this is our thoughts as purely as they come out of us. And so, you know, they each have a place, but I love them all. You know, obviously acting is really, really fun. And when you are working, you feel like you're so lucky because you're working. You know, those actors who just, you know, get so much work that they're turning it away. For us, we're still in the period that we're like, if we get it and we're on a show and we're doing stuff, it always is so much fun. We love it. Nice.
Well, now you got to parlay that John Hamm friendship into an appearance on Mad Men.
I would love that. That would be amazing. We got to work that. We got to work that angle.
There you go. Well, you do have a great, you guys do a great job making things sound really organic, and your interviews really come off naturally. But I want to know, what's the guest that intimidated you the most doing the podcast?
I would probably say Maron when we had him on because, you know, we've known Marc Maron for a long time. You know, our relationship has gone through several incarnations. I mean, it's like he saw us when we first started out in New York when we weren't very good. There are those who would say we still aren't very good. But I would say that he saw us back at a time when I would look back at our comedy and say, we've come a long way since that point. Mm-hmm. You know, and first impressions are hard to make always. So sometimes people see you the way you were when you were 23 years old. And that's just not who we are. Obviously, we're much older now. We've grown so much. We've learned so much. I feel like we've improved so much. But, you know, sometimes that's the way people see you. And it was a bummer that we came up in New York at a time when it was like Louis C.K. and Dave Chappelle and Dave Attell. And, you know, Dave Attell is a great example of somebody who you know, I think when he saw us first on the scene, he probably was not that impressed. Although over the time, he kind of saw us a little bit more. And then we did an episode of his show on Showtime, Day of Sold Porn, which is basically like Cheap Seats, but with porn. You're watching like a weird porn, and you're just making jokes. And I think we got on that show, and it was like right up our alley. And we made Dave laugh a bunch of times, which he doesn't really do. And from that point on, I think there was a really healthy level of respect. And he came on and did our podcast, and it just came from a much different place. You know, I don't know if, like, Marin, for whatever reason, I don't know if he fully respects everything that we do. So I was a little bit nervous, but I got to be honest with you, the last time we had him on County, I was so nervous. I'm like, is he going to play along with the stories and whatnot? He was great. He was really, really great, and I was nervous, but he was great.
Well, he is somebody that's notorious. I, with his podcast, I mean, when you're listening to it, it is like you'll get him in his mood, in whatever mood he's in. He's not going to change it just because he's doing a show. He's going to be exactly who he is at that time. So I can imagine right. That would be pretty tough.
And I expect that from him. And I, you know, but we had a good time. And we had fun. And we kind of didn't take any crap from him. And I mean, it was really fun. I would say he had a good time, too. And what was nice is that The Onion, who usually reviews podcasts, they kind of liked that he bowed to the format of the show a little bit, and it didn't take away from that. We actually got to see Marin in that sort of context. But, yeah, I mean, that was probably the one I was the most like, I hope this is going to go well. And it did. So.
Nice.
Well, something I really love about your podcast as well is that you guys introduce a lot of new music to the listeners.
And that's something we do, too. We try to feature a song, each of us, every week to try to expand people's music. And we definitely a tip of the hat to you guys for that idea. But when you're thinking about that, how do you pick your music each week?
Well, Jay and I mean, what's so great is I just remember a few years ago I was looking at the list of bands for South by Southwest, and I didn't know any of them. And I was kind of making fun of the fact that I just didn't know any of them. And I was just making fun of their names. And I just remember being like, who is this? What? Who is this band? And then we went down and did our podcast at South by Southwest last year. And I'm telling you, from being, you know, having to play 5 songs in one show and 4 songs in another show every week and being out there and listening to what's new and out there, I knew everybody. Nice. So I was like, oh, I want to see these people, and I want to see these people, and I want to see these. I was running around left and right wanting to see all these bands that we had sort of grown to know and love through doing the show. And what we do is we listen to a lot of Sirius XMU and on that breaks a lot of new music on Sirius Radio. And anytime something comes up that we like, just like tag it on your phone. Mm-hmm. Or if I'm in a store, I was in a store one time and I heard this unbelievable album, a country funk from like, which was just like country music but mixed with funk that from like 1969 to 1975. And I couldn't find the album. I actually found it on Amazon and downloaded it on Amazon. And there were like 7 tracks that were phenomenal. It was a compilation of artists from a label that doesn't exist anymore. But they were playing at this like cool clothing store in L.A., and I just Shazammed every single one of them. And I was like, I just take it every way we can. The other way is people send us suggestions, or people will go and do stand-up in a town, and someone will hand us a CD. And they're like, I made this compilation for you guys. There's a ton of stuff on here. And a lot of times, there's amazing stuff on there. Like, somebody in Toronto made us a CD of Edmonton bands. They either stayed in Edmonton, Ontario, or some made it out and left. But it was, like, the history of Edmonton alternative rock. And it was so cool that someone took the time to do that. It just was great. So we get it from all different sources.
Nice. Well, we're going to put you on the hot seat for just 1 minute. We always do a 6-pack of questions and rapid-fire questions. Sure. So to start off with, I'm a big Brad Johnson fan. Yeah, I know I'm the only one. But
yeah.
what obscure athlete are you a fan of?
What obscure athlete? I mean, we're huge fans of Jose Oquendo, 5-tool player. He was really a 9-tool player. I played at every position. We feel like he should be in the Hall of Fame. Even though he's just a utility man. Some people would say that because he's a utility man, that shows that he couldn't be an everyday player. But without him, how great would your team have been? I say Jose Alcando, we are huge fans of Jose Alcando.
All right, what is the weirdest thing in your tour rider?
In our tour rider?
Yeah, and if you want to sell out Jason for this,
you
can.
I think I want to put this in my tour rider. I want to now start putting this in there, that every single place has to find us. There's a thing called blown out field corn, which is basically like the half pop kernels at the bottom of the popcorn thing. I want that at every single venue. I want like a whole bowl of blown out field corn.
Nice.
Go in.
20 minutes and two beers in, we always have a beer, feature a beer. What's your favorite beer?
What's my favorite beer? Oh my goodness. I'm a Newcastle Brown fan. When I get off stage, it's usually the time that I want a beer, just to like bring it on down a notch. You know, I'm not a heavy drinker, but that post-show beer just goes down so smooth. And a Newcastle Brown, it's good. It's not too thick, yet I can drink like three or four of them. So that's my beer.
Spoken like the spokesman for them. Now, Randy, with Netflix's successful resurrection of Arrested Development, I want to know what show you want brought back to life and why.
I want Cheap Seats brought back to life, badly.
All right.
That would be so much fun to be able to do that show again in some other incarnation. I know I'm being selfish, but I freaking love doing that show, and I would do that in a split second, and let's do it for Netflix. Why not?
There you go.
Nice. How big is Brandon currently?
Guys, Brandon has gotten so big, he actually used the CN Tower in Toronto as a toothpick, and there was a Korean family inside the observation deck. He's gotten so big, you guys. Oh, Brandon's gotten so big.
All right, last question here, Randy. Battle Royale, two men enter, one man leaves. Tony La Russa versus Mike Ditka.
Ditka beats him every time, hands down. I love Tony La Russa for what he did for the Cardinals. I cannot agree with his politics. Lord knows what Ditka's politics are. I have no idea. But La Russa was at like a Sarah Palin rally. I'm like, that's unforgivable. And also La Russa like fell asleep at an intersection. So I'm not afraid to make fun of the man that brought us got us to several World Series and brought us two World Series championships. But I would say Ditka wins every time. Ditka wins and then sticks his sweater vest over his head where his arms can't move.
Outstanding.
Wonderful. Well, we love that you were able to take the time. Randy and Jason are going to be at Up Comedy Club Thursday recording their podcast at 8. They'll be there Friday doing stand-up at 8 and 10:30. We'll be there at 8 on Friday, so we'll give you a holler while we're there, Randy.
Please stop by afterwards and say hey. And I mean, the stand-up's great. And what I would say is, you know, the material we're doing at the podcast is totally different from the stand-up. Stand-up show's great. We have a great feature. His name is Nate Fritzen. He's one of our favorite comics. We bring him on the road. He was up there in Wisconsin when we did the cabin episode, if you guys heard that.
Yep, yep.
The cabin episode at Dan Van Kirk's cabin. He's such a funny comic, great young comic. So you'll see a great show. From what I hear, everybody who's been to the Up Theater absolutely loves it. It's a beautiful place to do comedy, and I'm so psyched to be in Chicago.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
You got it, buddy. Thank you so much, and we'll see you in Chicago.
Emily Wells had a terrific 2013 as that saw the release of the Pillow Fight album. That was her work with Dan the Automator, as well as Mama Acoustic Sessions, which is the acoustic recording of her album of that title. We talked to her back in July. It was on the heels of a European tour and also the release of that acoustic album. She also then went on to tour Europe again. So terrific 2013 for Emily Wells, and we were very happy to get her on the podcast. She plays violin, guitar, piano, drums, glockenspiels, even sings often at the same time on stage. 2013 has been a very busy year already, as she's released Pillow Fight, an album with Dan the Automator. In June, she released Mama Acoustic Recordings, which is an acoustic version of her 2012 Mama album. In between that, she found time to record songs for the soundtrack to the movie Stoker, and also has scored a film. Wow.
That's a lot.
I'm exhausted just saying that. We're very excited to have the incredibly talented Emily Wells here. Welcome, Emily.
Hey, thank you.
And Emily,
I'm a little exhausted too, just hearing that myself.
Before we get started, I want to let you know this is a drinking podcast. We always drink while we record, so we hope you have a beverage while you're talking to us. And if you are, that's perfectly fine.
You know, I was thinking about that before you called, and I just opened up a lovely bottle of kombucha. I don't know if that counts.
Well, the judges will we allow it.
We'll allow it.
We allow it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
Well, Emily, you just finished up your first tour of Europe. How was your time overseas?
I had a blast. It was pretty short and very, very busy, but I had the pleasure of opening for Kurt Vile, whose work I really enjoy, and it was great to see every night. And, yeah, it was just... I haven't spent that much time in Europe, so it's interesting to experience it as an American for the first time in a lot of places, and get to better than. I mean, there's no other way that I would really prefer to travel than to just be constantly welcomed with open arms. It's pretty nice. I mean, you have to sing for your supper, so to speak, but you know.
Well, and this was the first time that your music has ever been commercially released overseas. How does that feel for you?
It was really exciting. We actually released Mama the Original and Mama Acoustic as a double album. So I was like, yeah, you know, I'm just going to, my first release will be a double album. Why not, you know?
Why not? Well, and that's one thing that you were known for a long time. You did this all on your own. You didn't rely on a label. You let the music speak for itself. How difficult was that?
Well, you know, it's like, how difficult is it to do it well, I guess, is the question. There were things about it that were really great and things about it that I miss. But ultimately, it's just... I'm kind of at the point where I said, well, I don't really passionately want to be my own label. Like, that's not why I'm doing this. It's just kind of what I had done so far. And if I had, you know, a couple hundred more years, then sure, I'd perfect having my own label. But, you know, I wanted to really focus on the work and being a human being and... Put it in someone else's hands. That part of the works.
Yeah, and you know, you have been you produce your own stuff as well as writing it and recording it. So, how was Pillow Fight kind of letting go of that control? What feeling was that for you?
Yeah, it was an utterly different experience than making a record of my own. And I was actually working on Mama and Pillow Fight at the same time. And both those records were recorded quite some time before they were released, actually, due to various reasons. But, I went into Pillow Fight as just purely experiential. I mean, it was like, okay, I really admire you. You've got these fantastic tracks that you've created. And, you know, what can I do as a vocalist? And... You know, Dan and I spent, you know, most of our time either me locked away in another room in the studio, listening to and writing to the material, or eating amazing food around San Francisco, or, you know, philosophizing on music and gear and people, and we formed a really great friendship through the process as well. So for me, that was also one thing I really loved about making that record, was that it wasn't my normal, like, okay, bye everyone, I'm shutting myself up in my, you know, apartment or cabin or house or garage or wherever I might be recording. It was like a more communal experience in a lot of ways. So, fun.
You got to work on soundtracks, as Bobby mentioned earlier. How different of an experience is that? Obviously, there's a little bit more constraints to it. Was that difficult for you?
I would say it was challenging. It was different in that, yes, there were constraints, and yes, I was writing it for someone besides myself. But in that, I found a lot of pleasure in getting to do that. And, you know, having something to write for. A lot of composers, you know, they were writing for their church or for sort of outside source for some event or some crowning or whatever. You know, they were commissioned to create a lot of pieces, and there's something to that, you know, beyond just like, okay, well, I'm going to make a record. You know, it's like there's a purpose behind this, and both conceptually and just like a need for a song, and having a time that you have to create this piece within. So yeah, there's definitely pressure there, but there's. God, I learned so much from working with Park Chan-wook. You know, I had the pleasure of seeing kind of a rough cut of the film and talking with him at length a few different times about what his vision for the song was. But he's a rare breed of person who has a very clear vision and the ability to bring the people around him together within that vision while still allowing them to be themselves, allowing them to be creative, allowing them to be, you know, present, you know. So it's there's not a lot of people that I've met that can pull that off. I learned a lot from him.
Was working on that what enabled you? I think you've recently spoke about how you're going to be scoring a film, or you just finished scoring a film?
Yeah, I had been working on it for some time, actually. Two projects weren't really related, but I had been scoring a film about the life of Richard Brautigan, the author. And that was, a really unconventional experience because, you know, I've scored a couple short films, you know, but I haven't ever scored anything full length, and I didn't score this picture in a conventional way. There was a reaction to the work, not to a picture, not to a storyline, nothing like that. All I did was read Richard Brautigan, whose work I had not read before. I read him sort of obsessively and reacted to the work through my work. And that was a really interesting process because you kind of just got inside of another time. Mm-hmm. Both, you know, Richard Brautigan's time, him as an individual, but also there's a timelessness. I don't know if you're familiar with his work at all, but he kind of creates these different worlds, and they're not necessarily placed in the past, present, or future. There's this fluidity, you know, it's not so specific. And so that was really interesting to get to approach music that way. Again, a new set of constraints, but I think constraints are incredibly valuable to artists. I find them to me.
Well, Emily, I want to talk more about this past year for you and how busy you've been. But before we go into to Mama Acoustic Recordings, I want to play a track off that. We're going to play Johnny Cash's Mama's House.
Living it up in the poorhouse, records in the violin, spinning and squawking. Your eyelashes and your daily breath, learning by love in your little head. Mama laid in a pink cage, cooking it up in the back house. And hey, ain't never know what you had till you lost it. And hey,
Obviously, that takes on a different sound than the way it was originally recorded on Mama. What was your intent with these recordings?
It was a personal curiosity for me, these recordings. I had absolutely no intention of ever, you know, playing and singing acoustic guitar. I had kind of started writing songs that way many, many years ago as a young teenager. And I think that's a really important way to learn. It can be a really important way to learn. And someone had told me years and years ago that, you know, no song is a good song unless it's good on an acoustic guitar with a voice. You know, I remember at the time kind of saying, oh, whatever, you don't know what you're talking about. And trying to cite other things and trying to think about, at the time I was really interested in experimental music. So I've thought about that concept when I approached this work, and most of these songs weren't written using the guitar at all, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of like a teenager in my bedroom, like figuring out the simplest chords to play with these lyrics and these vocal melodies, so that was really interesting, just this incredibly stripped down sound. And there was something that was really gentle about that, but that was also part of the concept, because the record deals with some painful things, and so I had some time away from that era of my life, and so I was able to approach the songs more gently, sonically, but also sort of vocally and emotionally. So It was a cathartic experience. I don't think it was really even... As I got going, I kind of thought, maybe I want somebody to hear this, yeah. You know. And then by the time I got to the end, I was like, well, I want to hear this on vinyl, so maybe I'll press up a few copies. And then I sent it to the label and said, look, you know, my label's pretty chill, and we have kind of like a one record sort of agreement, and so they were the same song though, and I said, you know guys I'd love to just release these, I'll do it on my own, like, don't worry about it, I just need to get your blessing. And they said, please let us release these, we love them. So
nice.
I was like, all right, let's go for it.
Look, you know, it's funny looking through your history, and you mentioned you know, that teenager on the bed writing songs. Yeah, I think you were 13 when you put together a cassette. What, 100 cassettes you handed out with your first music?
Yeah.
When you're that 13-year-old kid, could you imagine the life you have now?
No, absolutely not. I mean, and I don't mean like... I think at 13, you just have no perception of what it is to to be an adult. To have the privilege of being an artist, whether you're making your living doing that or not. And certainly for me, these, you know, getting to travel and play and, I had no idea what it would be like, but I definitely have always kind of like felt that I wanted to play as much as I could.
Well, Emily, I want to ask you now about something I saw on your Twitter account a couple weeks ago, and it made me rethink something that is a habit of mine. And what I saw is...
You have a lot of bad habits, Bobby.
I do, yeah.
I don't know what...
this was the tweet. It's at Emily Wells Music. You said, the symphonies crossing over to the dark side at Spotify. And the symphonies obviously is one of your, the albums that you've released previously, and it was available now on Spotify. And my mm-hmm. bad habit is I have Spotify on my phone, I have Spotify on my work computer, I have Spotify at my home computer. I'm always listening to Spotify, and it made me think like, crap, what am I doing to the people that I absolutely love? You know, in your mind, is Spotify a bad thing for musicians?
You know, that's a tricky question, because musicians are also fans of music. At least I am, and I have, being my own label, as we discussed earlier, I can see the effects of Spotify in a very clear way. Mm-hmm. And I know that, and I might be a unique artist in this way, I'm not really sure. I don't have other people, you know, stats to compare to, but I make a fair amount of my living, or have made a fair amount of my living when I was my own label, off of selling, mostly off of iTunes, to be honest.
Okay.
This has been the thing that has kept me afloat, and I've really seen a change, you know, even in the last 5 years of a lot of streaming and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I can, on a really practical level, I can see it's affecting that way. But as a fan of music, well, I was asked to write an article about music that I love for an English paper or an English website.
Okay.
And I wrote the article, and they said, we want Spotify links for everything, right?
Okay.
And I'm like, I don't use Spotify. What are you guys, crazy? Like, no way. Like, come on. And but then I started thinking about it, and I was like, gosh, you know, I want the songs that I choose to. And a lot of the stuff that I listen to isn't even available on Spotify. So I listen to a lot of mixtapes and mashups and downloads and that are from shared websites of music from all over the world. And
mm-hmm.
But a lot of stuff that I'm interested in, it's actually quite amazing now that I've sort of been checking it out. It's just so vast, you know? So that's what I mean when I say, as a fan of music, I feel like I've gotten to experience a lot of things that I might not have otherwise experienced. You know, I'm a runner. I listen to music when I run all the time. It's just, so I've been having this new experience with music through Spotify. I ended up, I actually do pay for the service. I couldn't quite go all out and not pay for the service. But still, I mean, I've listened to like hundreds and hundreds of songs that I don't own, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why I put symphonies eventually on to Spotify was I kind of felt that I wanted that record to be a part of the conversation, so to speak.
Okay.
And that leaving the record off of Spotify kind of defeated the purpose, because it kind of removed the record from the conversation of my work and in relation to other people's work. And and like you said, you know, you listen to Spotify everywhere, you know, and I find myself listening to it more and more. It's easy. It's so easy. They have made a brilliant product, and it's just so streamlined. And
mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I think I just kind of have to accept that this is the reality, and make beautiful pieces of vinyl and put on great shows and try to just work within the new parameters. Again, the same concept of, you know, restrictions or things for within your work pushing you to do something else. And because of these confines, you therefore create something new that you might not have otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Emily,
you know,
Emily, I will say, I fought Bobby on Spotify for a long time. He's like, you got to do it. You got to do it. Everything's in your face. And I'm like, no, because it hurts the artist. Yeah. I went toe-to-toe with you, sir.
You did.
I did.
And then you caved.
I caved. I went Google Plus, which is the same thing.
Well, here, I have a trick. And, Emily, this is what you can do now. I have a trick for, and this is all the Emily Wells fans that are listening right now. Here's what you should do. And I learned this from one of our listeners who, when he's at work and he leaves his office or he steps out and he's done for the day, he will leave his computer on and he will turn an album of his friends on and he will hit it on loop so that Spotify will just track that this guy played this album so many times to try to boost the money for that guy.
That's brilliant.
So there you go, Emily. That's what we're going to do to make sure that...
Everybody this week, do that for Emily.
Okay, well, yes, I look forward to those 21 cents over the course of the year and a half. Yes, thank you very much.
Well, another trend, Emily, that I've been seeing a lot lately in music is a lot of artists are self-releasing using Kickstarter and Pledge Music. Have you ever given any thought to using something like that once you're done with the distribution label that you're using?
Yeah. I've given that some thought. You know, I wouldn't diss that. It works for a lot of people. I don't know if that's the route that I would want to take. I mean, to me, a label should be more than just money.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, the label is a collaborator. I don't necessarily mean artistically, but that they are a family, you know, in some way or another. That's ultimately what I would seek in a label. So, you know, I think that for me, it's not so much about needing the capital, but rather just wanting that that family, that community, or that sort of push. And also, if you go with Kickstarter, then I'm still back in the same boat of being like, well, how do I utilize these funds? How do I best apply what I have, you know? And I feel like I did the best I could with what I had. And that's not just talking about money. That's talking about, you know, just my own mind, my own willpower to care about that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, I know a lot of people use that, and I love the idea of, you know, sort of community-funded projects of lots of different types, so I don't knock it, but
yeah.
I don't know. Who knows? Who knows what the future holds? But
well, Emily, speaking
that's
of
that's not my secret plan. Yeah, come on, my secret plan.
When's the next time we're going to see you in Chicago, Em?
Well, to be honest, I'm not going to tour in the U.S. for a little while. I'm going back to Europe, but I really want to make a new record. So I'm working on demos for that right now, and the record's pretty much written. So my goal is to not really fully tour in the U.S. until that record's done. So hopefully, you know, next spring I'll be seeing you again.
So are you telling me that you're going to take all your new gems over to Europe and they're going to be listening to them before us? That's cold, Emily. That's cold.
You know, I was playing some of those songs on my last U.S. tour. It's old news to the U.S.
All right. Well, Emily, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. And
my pleasure.
Best of luck. Keep good luck on what you're working on right now. And you've already had a busy enough year. You can take a little time off. We're going to allow it right now.
Thank you. I need that. I am like the worst. I take a day and I'm like, you're such a failure. Come on, get it together. Well, so I appreciate that.
All right, Emily. Well, we can't wait to hear more from you. And take care.
All right. Thank you. See you in Chicago.
Well, that's it for us this week. Hope you enjoyed our favorite interviews of 2013. And big thanks to everybody who was on the podcast this year. We had some great guests. This is just a small, small sampling. We can't wait for 2014, everybody. We got some great surprises. We're going to be entering season 4, have all new guests. So great times ahead. We will see you next week.